Matthew chapter 22, we're picking up in verse 15. Matthew 22, picking up in verse 15 in our study. Could someone tell me what day it is in the final week of Jesus' death, where we're at in the context? Tuesday, remember? All of these things have been transpiring on Tuesday. Now, we have a little ways to go before we get to another day, but the things that we're going to study tonight are still taking place on Tuesday. Remember, it was Tuesday when they came back to the city of Jerusalem from Bethany. The apostles observed the withered fig tree, and then Jesus came into the temple, and he was questioned by the chief priest and the elders of the people in verse 23 about his authority. And then after that, he presented three parables, all connected with that question about his authority. And of course, these individuals to whom he was speaking, evidently a delegation from the Sanhedrin Council, since it consisted of the chief priest and elders of the people, they understood that he was speaking of them in regard to these parables, that he spoke about their coming destruction, as well as the destruction of the city. But he continues on this Tuesday in the temple, teaching and preaching the will of God. And we're going to see now, beginning in verse 15 through the end of the chapter, at least through verse 40, three different groups of people coming to him. Actually, just you might say two. Pharisees try to make another stab at trying to trick him or entrap him. With questions. And that's what we're going to deal with tonight. Questions that they pose to Jesus, hoping that they might be able to entrap him in some way. Beginning in verse 15 of Matthew 22, in the New King James Version, "Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk." The Pharisees. We've seen the Pharisees before. One of the religious groups during this particular period of time, they were very strict according to the law of Moses, not like the Sadducees, who we'll study about later on, who did not even believe in the resurrection of the dead or spirits or angels. And so these Pharisees, of course, they we might say they were the ultra-conservative of the day, though they were very hypocritical in the way that they conducted themselves and the way that they had taught the Word of God. They simply did not live their life as they taught. So the Pharisees went and plotted, that is, they counseled together with one another, that is, a group of them did, how they might entangle him. The word entangle here means to catch in a trap, how they might catch him in a trap, how they might entrap him. Note, in his talk, in his speech, that is, in something he would say, perhaps in an answer to a question that they would pose to him. Verse 16, "And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying," so these Pharisees that had gotten together, had plotted and counseled together how they might entrap Jesus, "they sent to him their disciples." Yes, the Pharisees had disciples. Disciples, same word that's used in reference to the disciples of John the Baptist, the disciples of Jesus. Simply learners, students, but more than that, they're adherents. Adherents to the teachings of the Pharisees. And so that which the Pharisees teach, they make it a part of their life. They practice that which the Pharisees teach. So the Pharisees that had counseled together and plotted together to entangle Jesus in what he might say, sent to him their disciples with the Herodians. The Herodians, of course, they're not a religious sect, a religious group. They're more of a political faction. They're just partisans. They're unlikely friends here, because the Pharisees would perhaps have had nothing to do with the Herodians, and the Herodians would have had nothing to do with the Pharisees, except both of them wanted to entrap Jesus. Both of them wanted to be able to condemn him in order to put him to death. The Herodians were those who sided with the family of the Herods. even from Herod the Great until now, Herod Antipas, perhaps under consideration. They sided with the Herod family, and they were always putting them forward and hoping that they would continue in their rule and reign. And so they were adherents to the family of Herod as well as to the Caesars. And so if everything continued like the Caesars wanted and like the Herod family wanted, then they would be happy. They just wanted to continue with the status quo, you might say, as a political party. And so the Pharisees and the Herodians have gotten together on this occasion to entrap Jesus. And so they sent the disciples along with the Herodians. "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person." Teacher. I believe, if I remember correctly, I think the King James Version says master. It's actually the word for teacher in the Greek. It's a term not unlike, you might say, the term rabbi. It's a very respectful term that they address Jesus with. And beginning with that term and showing respect for him, they speak some things that are intended to, you might say, butter him up. Some things that are intended to show that they hold him in high esteem. Some things that we would hope could perhaps be said of us. And so they're doing this in order to maybe say, well, if we butter him up and say good things about him, maybe he'll trip on his pride. Maybe his haughtiness will get the best of him, and he'll say something in which we can entrap him with. So, teacher, we know that you are true. We know that you're truthful. We know that you're honest. We know that you're sincere. We know that that you're a man of integrity. They really don't believe that, but that's what they're saying. We'll see how he refers to them, later on. But these are things that were actually true of him. They were indeed true of him. He was indeed sincere and honest and truthful. He was a man of integrity. But they didn't believe it, though they were saying it. Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. And teach the way of God. The way, of course, way here is literally a highway. It was translated that way earlier in chapter 21. Go out into the highways. So it's literally a road or a path or a highway. But here it has reference to his conduct, his behavior. We know that you are true and teach the way of God. It's the conduct or behavior that God would approve of. You teach the way of God. It would be equivalent, we might say, to the way of righteousness that John came in back in chapter 21. Back in chapter 21, where it says, what verse was that? Verse 32. Okay, I was looking in the wrong place. Verse 32, yes. "For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him." So the way of God here, the way or conduct or behavior that God would approve of, John came in the way of righteousness. We might say those would be equivalent terms, equal terms. It is a term, the way of God is often spoken of in the Old Testament scriptures as the way of the Lord, the way of God. And so here he says, they say, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth." That is, you're truthful in the way you teach the way of God. It is in harmony with that which is true. "Nor do you care about anyone." Now, when you read that phrase, don't take it as literal that he doesn't care about anyone, because that phrase is to be understood with the next phrase, "For you do not regard the person of men." You do not care about anyone. He cares about people. He's saying you don't care about people's status. You don't care about people's standing. You don't care about whether they're rich or whether they're poor. What they're saying is you're not prejudiced. You don't look upon the person's appearance. You don't regard the person of men. He doesn't show respect of persons. That's the idea. And, of course, he did not. But the reason they add that is because there's Pharisees here and the Herodians here. So he's going to treat them the same way. He's going to answer their question truthfully, because he doesn't care if the Herodians back Herod and the Romans. He doesn't care if the Pharisees are ultra conservative. He doesn't look upon men's appearance. He doesn't prejudge them based upon whether they have high status or low status, whether they're rich or whether they're poor, whether they're black or whether they're white. He doesn't show respect of persons. So he's going to be truthful and honest to them. "Tell us, therefore," that is, because he is these things that they just said he was, "tell us, therefore, what do you think?" Some versions say, "What's your opinion?" But he's not going to give his opinion. What do you think? What do you suppose is the idea? Is it lawful? Is it right? Is it lawful in regard to the law of Moses? That's what they're asking. To pay taxes to Caesar or not? Is it lawful? Is it right? To pay taxes, give tribute, if I remember correctly, the King James Version says. It's just the idea of paying taxes. Taxes under consideration is a poll tax, you might say. And, of course, the Herodians would be the first ones to say it's right to pay taxes that is required of us. Of course, the Pharisees, they would go back to the old law and say, well, we should not pay taxes to a king who is a foreigner, one who is not a Jew, because the old law taught that they were not to subject themselves to a king who was a foreigner. They were not to choose one who was to rule or reign over them as a king, being a foreigner. Well, they had not done that. But the way the Pharisees saw it is, it was unlawful according to the law of Moses to pay taxes. And of course, those of the zealots would seek to do what they could to keep from paying taxes. And so the Pharisees are hoping that he will answer the question and say it is unlawful according to the law of Moses to pay taxes, because the old law teaches that we should not subject ourselves to a foreign king. And the Herodians, of course, would be happy with it if he says it's all right to pay taxes. And so he's going to get caught one way or the other in their trap, they suppose, regardless of how he answers. Because they suppose he has only one of two choices. But he has more. Note his wisdom. "Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, "Why do you test me, you hypocrites?" He perceived their wickedness. That is, he knew their wickedness. They were not going to get anything over on Jesus, because how could they get something over on Jesus who knows what's already in the minds of men to begin with? He could read their minds. It says he perceived their wickedness. Now, sometimes someone might try to pull something over on you, and you might perceive or realize what's happening. Did Jesus do that? Did he just sense that, hey, they're tricking me, they're trying to entrap me? No, he already knew what was in their heart. He already knew what was in their mind, because he's deity. But he perceived their wickedness, and this word translated wickedness means maliciousness, evil intent. He knew what their evil intent was. Their evil intent was to entrap him, to ensnare him in the things that he would say, so they could bring about his death. So why do you test me? That word test, why do you tempt, King James Version says. It is a word that can be used in a good way or a bad way. Here it's used in a bad sense. They're putting him to the test. They're proving him. They're tempting him. Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Now, why does he refer to them as hypocrites on this occasion? Because they were. They had just feigned, in verse 16, good things about Jesus, but they didn't believe any of it. They said it, but they didn't believe any of it. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't have called him a teacher if they could have gotten away with calling him something else. They were indeed hypocrites. They certainly were not of the character that they described Jesus as being in verse 16. And so Jesus knew what was in their heart. And so his response to them, his answer to them, is, "Show me the tax money." And they brought him a denarius. "Show me the tax money. Show me the tribute money," I think the King James Version says. "Show me the tax money." Again, that word tax means a poll tax. Literally, the Greeks called it a head tax. That is, if you was counted as one of the citizens of that province, then you would have to pay a tax, kind of like our poll tax. If you're recognized as a citizen in the county and you're going to vote here, you're going to pay a tax. If you drive a car here, if you park your car in your driveway at night, you're going to pay a tax. So a tax was required of them as well. And he says, "Show me the tax money." Money here is coin. "Show me the tax coin. Show me the coin that you pay the tax with." So they bring him a Roman silver coin, a denarius, penny, the King James Version says. But it was equal to a day's wages. So this is the Roman coin that would be used to pay taxes with. Now remember, we studied about another coin earlier. Remember, the tax gatherers came to Jesus on one occasion and to pay the temple tax. That was a different coin, remember? Different kind of coin. It was a coin that the Jews used to pay the tax at the temple. Remember, Peter found it in the mouth of a fish when Jesus made it appear there to pay the tax with at the temple. But this is a coin specifically used in commerce throughout the Roman society, and you had to pay your tax in this coin. So they brought this coin that was to be used to pay taxes with. They brought it to Jesus just as he asked. And he said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" Just as our coins have an image on it, so did their coins have an image as well. Anyone know whose image it might have been on it? This particular coin, denarius? Caesar's, Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius Caesar. He was the ruling emperor at that time. And perhaps it was an image of his face imprinted on the coin, Tiberius Caesar. And there was a superinscription or an inscription on the coin as well, written on there, you know, inscribed or a super inscription, that would say something to the fact that about Tiberius Caesar being a son of divine Augustus or something like that, I believe. Recognizing him as an offspring of Caesar Augustus and referring to him as divine. And so that would be on this coin, on this denarius. So he said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Well now, all the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to God. Doesn't this silver coin belong to God? Well, yes, in a sense it does. But the point that Jesus is making here is this coin had been specifically minted by the authority of Caesar, and so it belonged to Caesar. So give back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Anything that belonged to Caesar, it's rightfully his. So render or pay back, therefore, to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. It's his, give it back to him. It's not yours, give it back to him. And to God the things that are God's. So you render to God the things that are God's, and you render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Now what do we have that belongs to God?
Ourselves.
We're each created in the image of God. God's image is stamped on our soul. So we give ourselves to God. And we give that which belongs to Caesar to Caesar. Same thing is true today. We have money, but what is money? Give it back to the government. They minted it. They produced it. Give it back to them. Of course, we need money to live on. But what's more important, our soul or the money? So he's answered them in a way, of course, they did not expect. In verse 22, when they had heard these words, they marveled. They were amazed. They were astonished. And they left him and went their way, because there was no way they could entrap him or trick him by saying something that the Herodians could use and then take him to Herod Antipas or the Roman emperor and have him put to death for. And there was nothing that he said that the Pharisees could have used to say that he violated the law of Moses in any way and the teaching. And so they were just, you might say, speechless. When they heard these words, they marveled, they were amazed, they were astonished, and they left him and went their way. But the same day, again, this is on a Tuesday, the same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him. So each group of those who have great influence over the children of Israel at this time, each group take their turn seeking to entrap Jesus in some way that they can find a means by which they can put him to death. It started with the Sanhedrin Council, the chief priest and the elders of the people, evidently a delegation from them, and then the Pharisees, and now the sect of the Sadducees. The same day, the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. Right, say there is no resurrection. They came to him and asked him. They say there is no resurrection. That is, they say there's no literal resurrection of the dead. That's what the Sadducees taught. Now, we just studied in our epistles to Timothy that there were some who had taught that the resurrection was already past. Those who taught that the resurrection was already past evidently were not Sadducees, because the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection at all. And you note their hypocrisy here. They come asking a question about the resurrection, And they don't even believe in the resurrection. Isn't that something? They don't even believe in the resurrection, but yet they're going to ask a question about the resurrection. That tells you something about the heart of these people as well. They're seeking to entrap him, just as the Pharisees were. They're not really wanting to know the answer to the question because they don't even believe in the resurrection. What the Sadducees believed is when one died, he was like an animal. He was gone. No resurrection. Saying, "Teacher," now note how they began again. "Master," I believe, the King James Version says, but again this group approaches him in a very respectful way. "Teacher, Moses said that if a man dies having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up offspring for his brother." Now, if you're not familiar with this, I'd like to just take time to turn over to Deuteronomy, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 25. There are several occasions of this in the Old Testament scriptures. Just read for just a moment Deuteronomy 25 about what they're asking. Deuteronomy 25. Let's pick up at about verse 5. Read through verse 10. Verse 5. Deuteronomy 25. "If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her." Now before we read on, can anyone think of an example of someone doing this in an entire book of the Old Testament is kind of written around it? Ruth, yes. She married a kinsman, Boaz. That's an occasion of it. Verse 6 of Deuteronomy 25. "And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel." See, it had to do with the inheritance of the property and carrying on the family name. Verse 7, "But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, 'My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother.' Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, but if he stands firm and says, 'I do not want to take her,'" that is, "I do not want to take her for my wife, "then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, 'So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house.' And his name shall be called in Israel, 'The house of him who had his sandal removed.'" Yes, it was something that was very, that was expected. It was something that was greatly expected if your brother died, leaving no offspring to inherit, and no one to see after the widowed mother. It was expected of someone in that family to take care of them, even through marriage. And so that's the question that is being posed here. That's the passage that this centers around, you might say. This question centers around. Moses said that if a man dies having no children, having no offspring, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up offspring, that is, raise up children for his brother. Now they give a hypothetical. "Now there were with us seven brothers. The first died after he had married, and having no offspring or no children, left his wife to his brother. Likewise, the second also, and the third even to the seventh. Last of all, the woman died also." Last of all, that is in time. The word "last" here simply has reference to time. "In time, she also died like her previous husbands. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they all had her. That is, they all had her as a wife. She was married seven times. She had seven husbands. So they want to know, in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? Again, they do not believe in the resurrection, so why pose a question to him about the resurrection? They simply want to show the absurdity of the teaching of the resurrection. They think it is an absurd doctrine. They think the doctrine does not make sense, the doctrine concerning the resurrection of the dead. It doesn't make sense. And to show how absurd it is, they've come up with this fictitious account to show how absurd the doctrine of the resurrection is, because they don't believe in it to begin with. Verse 29, Jesus answered and said to them, "You are mistaken, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God. You are mistaken. You err," the King James Version says. Actually, the idea in the word is not mistaken. They're not mistaken in what we might say, they've just made a simple mistake. The word "err" in the King James Version is more closely. It describes literally going astray, erring off a path. But here it has reference to them being deceived. They're deceived. They've misled themselves. They've deceived themselves in regard to what the Scriptures teach. So that's how mistaken they are. And how have they deceived themselves? How have they erred from the truth? How have they strayed from the truth in regard to what the Scriptures actually teach about the resurrection? Well, in two ways. First of all, not knowing the Scriptures, and second of all, not knowing the power of God. Not knowing the Scriptures. They don't know the Scriptures. They don't have an accurate understanding of the Scriptures, because they could go to the Old Testament Scriptures and they could verify the fact of the resurrection of the dead. But they don't know the Scriptures. They don't have an accurate understanding and knowledge of the Scriptures. So they've deceived themselves. They've misled themselves. They've led themselves astray in regard to the doctrine of the resurrection. Not only have they led themselves astray because they have not an accurate knowledge and understanding of the Scriptures, but they don't know the power of God. They don't know the power that God has, the inherent ability that He has. They've erred in that. They've deceived themselves in that. God, who can speak man into existence, certainly has the power to reunite the spirit of man with man's body. If God has the power to form man from the dust of the ground, God has the power and the ability to reunite His spirit with His body. They don't recognize that. They don't realize that. So that's how they've erred, in two ways: not knowing the Scripture nor knowing the power of God. Then he says, "For in the resurrection they," that is man in general, "for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God." They're like angels in heaven. Some versions omit the word God. It's in some Greek texts, and some texts it's not. Doesn't matter whether it's in the text or not, actually. The understanding is still good, with it or without it. They're like angels of God. They're like angels in heaven. Now, in what respect are they like angels in heaven? Not in every respect. The word "like" here is equivalent to, or equal to, you might say. And they're equal to or equivalent to them only in that which is under consideration in the context: marriage. Some would carry this a step further and say, well, they're like angels. They're like angels. They have no sex, but They forget that angels are always spoken of in the masculine gender in the Scriptures. Now, whether they are all males, we don't know. But nonetheless, they're always spoken of in the masculine gender. But here, the likeness of angels to men, or the likeness of men to angels, is only in the fact that in the resurrection, no one will be married. They don't marry nor give one another in marriage in the resurrection. There will be no marriage. And then he tries to correct their self-deception about the resurrection and teach them that the Scriptures imply, and they can infer from what the Scriptures say, that there is such thing as a resurrection of the dead. Verse 31. But concerning, or touching, the King James Version says, but in respect to the resurrection, but concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God, saying, and this was said at the burning bush, where God spoke to Moses and said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but He is the God of the living. Literally, God is not the God of the dead ones, but He is the God of the living ones. Now, what living ones do you suppose is under consideration in that? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When God spoke that to Moses, these individuals had long been dead. But God said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead ones. God is not the God of these dead ones, but of the living ones. They're alive. That's the implication. That's the inference that we draw from this. That these individuals, though they're dead physically, they're very much still alive. And you say, well, how does that prove the resurrection? Well, by inference it proves the resurrection because they're alive. The resurrection itself is a standing up again. It's a making live again. They're still alive. It'll be easy for them to stand up again in a physical sense when their spirit reunites with their body because they're still alive. That's what a resurrection from the dead is. It's a making them alive again. Well, they're still alive. It proves by inference the resurrection. Verse 33, and here's one of those examples. You know, we say we're able to justify what we teach and practice by direct command, necessary inference, and approved apostolic example. Well, here's a necessary inference. Jesus used an inference here from the Old Testament Scriptures to teach that they were still alive. Verse 33, and when the multitudes heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. When the multitude, of course, there were people who were gathered around as they listened to these Pharisees ask their question and become astonished or amazed, and as the Sadducees asked their question, as they posed this hypothetical, the multitude, the crowd of people that is gathered around, they're astonished at his teaching. They're amazed. He taught as one having authority. Indeed, he was a master teacher. We'll pick up at verse 34 next Wednesday evening because we're out of time. Thought we'd get through with that. I just got too long-winded. Questions or comments over what we went over, though? All right, Matthew 22 and verse 34 next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention.